WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The documentary Baghdad ER is an unflinching look at the 86th Combat Support Hospital in Iraq. It's just been honored with the Peabody Award. A review panel called it a horrifying and humbling testament to the extraordinary dedication of medical personnel confronting the overwhelming carnage of war. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with filmmakers John Alpert and Matt O'Neill. Also, we remember novelist Kurt Vonnegut. He died Wednesday at the age of 84. We'll listen back to a 1986 interview with him. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Black Book, the new thriller set during the Nazi invasion of Holland by Paul Verhoeven. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The HBO documentary Baghdad ER has been honored with a Peabody Award for Excellence in Broadcasting. The film, now available on DVD, tells the story of wounded soldiers and their doctors at the 86th Combat Support Hospital, the Army's premier medical facility in Iraq. It was shot over the course of 2 months in 2005. Last year, Terry Gross spoke to the filmmakers, John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill. Alpert, the senior member of the duo, has won 12 Emmy Awards for his documentaries. Over 3,200 Americans have been killed in Iraq since March 2003, but over 24,000 have been wounded. This film graphically shows the condition of wounded soldiers, many of whom have had limbs blown off by IEDs, improvised explosive devices, or have had limbs amputated in the hospital. Here's a short scene from the film, in which we hear two wounded soldiers at the hospital calling home to break the news.
Hey, Mom. I'm in the hospital. I don't know where the hell I am. I'm in a hospital somewhere. Yeah, I got hit by an IED today. I'm not too bad considering the way the vehicle looked.
Hey, honey. How you doing? I'm doing, fine, but guess what? I got hit with IED. Well, I was gunning. And, all it did was, I was on top of the vehicle, like where Davis is at. And all I heard was the explosion. It happened so fast.
John Alpert, Matthew O'Neill, welcome to Fresh Air. John, why did you want to make a movie about an emergency room, about a combat hospital in Baghdad?
I thought it might be a way to be able to show both the horror of war, which I think people really always need to know about if a country is at war, and also the heroism of the people that we're sending over there to fight that war. I thought we might find those two things intersecting in the emergency room of the hospital in Baghdad.
Would you describe the combat hospital that you ended up filming?
Yeah, it's easier for us to describe in words because we weren't allowed to film the exterior for security purposes. That was one of the conditions of our embedded agreement, that we couldn't do anything that compromised the safety of the soldiers, and we followed that agreement to the letter. The Army's obligation on their part was to give us total access to the hospital, and they followed that to the letter. This is a hospital that's not very big. It has an emergency room that has four beds in it, and it has an operating room that has four beds in it. And sometimes you can't fit all the people in, and the helicopters keep coming. The bodies are loaded off the helicopter with limbs dangling and blood spurting out, and it's one of the most frightening things I've ever seen in my life, but also one of the most heroic when you see these doctors go to work to try to save lives.
You show a lot of violence in the film. And you don't show the violence, you show the results of violence. You're showing a part of war that the public is usually protected from, a part that soldiers are often reluctant to talk about when they return home. And I'm referring to really grotesque open wounds, amputations. We see part of an amputation. We see one of the doctors or perhaps a nurse taking a removed limb and discarding it in a special trash bag. How did you decide how graphic you would allow the film to be?
We actually decided that we couldn't show the reality of that hospital because it was too graphic. If you've never seen an amputation, it's something that scars you forever, and we backed way off. The first cut of this program was so violent that it sent people screaming out of the room. And we wanted to show the reality of war, but we just couldn't. And the soldiers are actually surprised because they said, "Wow, this is nothing compared to what was going on there every single day. You're just showing the pinky on an amputated hand." And we just had to do that because we wanted people to be able to get through the whole program and to be able to understand the horror of the war without saying, "I can't watch this," and tuning in an American Idol program instead.
Yeah, one of the things that you witness up close in the movie is the vulnerability the frailty of the human body. I mean, we see bodies really torn up. And I guess I wonder if you asked yourself, is during a war a bad time to be focusing on how vulnerable the human body is in war?
I don't think there's a more appropriate time to focus on the vulnerability of the human body. I mean, this film shows you the horror of what man can do to man. And it's important to recognize that any war, and this war in particular, involve a lot of frail human bodies getting hurt by very crude instruments of destruction. You know, these IEDs are put together with spit and bubble gum wrapped around nails and whatever other detritus that the insurgents can find to create a bomb. And that's part of the reason why the wounds are so dangerous and so many infections come from them, because they're not coming in with bullet wounds. They're coming in literally exploded, blown up.
Could you talk a little bit more about why these wounds are so problematic to treat?
When the soldiers come in injured from an IED attack, they often don't look like people anymore because, as I said, the improvised explosive devices are put together sometimes from garbage, so they cause all sorts of horrific infections. And that's part of the reason that the combat support hospital works so hard to get the soldiers out of the war zone as quickly as possible. One of the things that I found very interesting was the speed with which they would move a soldier from the site of his injury all the way out to Landstuhl, Germany, where they have their first-class, first-world medical facility. And you could get injured on a street in Baghdad and in less than 10 hours be in a German hospital.
The resources that are put to try and save the lives of not only American soldiers but injured Iraqis and, in many cases, the people who were trying to kill our soldiers, the enemies of our soldiers, is just amazing. And the hospital was filled with as many Iraqis as they had wounded soldiers.
What did you have to do to get permission from the doctors to film in the hospital? Or did they have to give you your permission? And what about the soldiers? I mean, you have soldiers in the beginning of the film, you have soldiers being wheeled in on gurneys naked with their bodies torn up from these IED explosions. Did they give their permission before or after?
Every soldier you see receiving care in this film by the 86 Cash signed a release. Mm-hmm. And the doctors and the hospital staff and the soldiers themselves were all very rightfully proud of the work that's going on at the Combat Support Hospital. And so they were, in most cases, eager to do so. On Monday night, we screened the film down in Washington with a number of the soldiers who were in the film and with a number of the doctors from the cache. And one soldier came up to me afterwards, and I had been very nervous about him seeing the film for the first time because he's one of those soldiers that you see in a very tender, very emotional moment after having lost one of his comrades. And when I asked him to sign the release in Baghdad, he hesitated, and he said, "Are you guys going to use this for a politically manipulative film? Is this going to be another Fahrenheit 9-1-1? And I promised him that it wouldn't be. And I promised him that we would take a completely objective point of view and it would be an apolitical film. But I never knew how he would feel about sharing that moment with a national audience. And he came up to me after the film and he thanked me because he said that we did it. We managed not to have a political bent on this film. And then his comrade who was there with him in the hospital said, "And you know what? I think it's important for Americans to know that sometimes soldiers cry."
Well, you know, I'm really glad you brought this up because I think there's two times in the movie when soldiers cry. And both of those times, they're crying because of the death of a buddy. Nobody in the movie is crying over themselves. The soldiers are so stoic about their own injuries. I just found it amazing. When you look at what's happening to their bodies, and they're just dealing with it. It was just remarkable to me.
Before we went over, every commander we spoke to in the Army would tell us that we would be shocked how every soldier that got injured, the first thing he would do is ask to go back.
Yeah, and you show that. There's a guy who's got shrapnel in his eye. He might be blinded forever in that eye. And when the surgeon tells him that they're going to have to send him to the United States or Germany for the surgery, he looks very, I mean, he's controlling his disappointment and anger because he doesn't want to leave. And that too was very surprising to me.
And that soldier is actually back in Iraq. He, through modern military medicine, he regained all of his eyesight. And a couple of months ago, I called his home hoping to speak to him to see how he was doing. And I got his wife on the line, and she said to me, "Oh, no, you know, he got 20/20 vision." And I said, "That's fantastic." And there was silence. She said, "Well, now he's in Kuwait on his way back to Baghdad." And it's interesting. These guys who are getting patched up after horrific injuries really are doing everything in their power to get back into the fight. And really, I think, to get back to their buddies, because the bonds that they form with each other are very, very strong.
Yeah, there were a couple of things that really surprised me about our experience in Iraq. And one was the adhesion that the soldiers have for each other. And when you're over in Iraq, it's not a pleasant environment. It's 130 degrees. It's 140 degrees. There are people waiting around almost every corner to blow you up into little pieces. And in many cases, if you ask the soldiers what they're fighting for, maybe they don't even know. But their buddy is next to them. Their buddy is there to protect them. And you're going through this together, and you cannot let your buddy down.
They're fighting for each other.
Yeah.
What kind of training did the doctors at this combat hospital have? They're called on to do things. The medicine's just really different than what you'd be doing, say, at an emergency room in the United States. I mean, as you've described, you have these IEDs with horrible pieces of filthy shrapnel, and then there's a lot of amputations that are performed. What kind of training do they have before they actually get there?
In many cases, unfortunately, there is nothing that can prepare anyone for what they wind up encountering. It's like being dropped off into the middle of the chainsaw massacre, and there's nothing that can prepare you for that. And the doctors say that how in the world can you prepare somebody to amputate two legs and two arms every single day? You can't. There's no training for it. And often there's no cure for the disturbances that you suffer except that you know that you're doing the right thing and that you're helping people. And that's what gets them through it. They wake up in the morning knowing that they're going to save somebody's life that day, and it helps them deal with the really scary things that come in the door.
And the unfortunate fact that they'll probably lose someone that day, too.
You know, you told us a little bit about getting the permission of the doctors and of the injured soldiers. Was it hard to get permission from the military to make the movie in the first place?
The military was astonishingly cooperative. We became officially embedded, and there's a 13-page embedded agreement that has some fine print in it, but basically it boiled down to just a couple of very simple things. We couldn't do anything to compromise the security of any of the installations and the security of the soldiers. So in this film, you won't see any nice exteriors. You have really no idea where the hospital is located. And that's to make it difficult for people to drive bombs into the hospital. And our obligation to the Army was to give them the film so that they could look at it and comment on it, but not so they could censor it. We weren't obligated to do anything in reaction to their viewing. And the Army was obligated to facilitate our trip, to give us access, to feed us, to protect us. And in the almost 40 years of filmmaking, I have never received such cooperation from anyone. They let us film anything we wanted. The only thing we couldn't film were some of the enemy combatants who came into the hospital, and that's only because the Geneva Convention doesn't allow you to parade prisoners in front of cameras. Otherwise, they would have let us film it.
But let me stop you there. So the doctors were treating enemy combatants?
A lot of them. You know, I mean, I got really excited, because this was one of the few different things that happened. You know, normally you hear the chuck, 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 chuck from the helicopters, and you go, gosh, here it comes again. And in comes a half of a body on a gurney with somebody desperately pumping on their chest trying to keep them alive. But One day, this guy in an orange jumpsuit came in. He was manacled hand, manacled feet, and he had these really weird goggles on. And I said, "Whoa, this is different." And I go, you know, running across the room with my camera, almost got tackled by the public affairs officer. And I said, "Oh gosh, why don't they want me to film this?" And she explained, "This is an enemy combatant, and the Geneva Convention does not allow us to let you take pictures of him." But there were a lot of them, and it's really strange. You'll have on one bed an American soldier who was blown into smithereens, desperately trying to keep this guy alive, and on the other bed is the guy that was trying to kill him, and they're trying to save both of these guys' lives, and they're working just as hard on both of them. That was amazing.
How did the doctors feel about that?
I think they had some pretty complicated emotions when it came right down to it. It didn't stop them from doing their best job professionally, but I think it was one of the more difficult things that they wrestled with. I remember one operating room nurse telling me that after a certain insurgent came in and they saved his life, and they saved his life by replacing the blood he had lost with American blood, with the blood that they had in their blood bank there. And she said that she waited until that insurgent woke up and she grabbed one of the translators because she wanted him to know that the blood that had saved his life had been the blood of American soldiers.
John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill directed the documentary Baghdad ER. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill, recorded last year. Their documentary Baghdad ER, about a combat hospital in Iraq, has just been selected for a Peabody Award. Let's hear another clip from the film.
Special Spurlock, one of the things we don't like to do is see anybody hurt. If we issue a Purple Heart, it's one of the nation's richest, most valued and respected award given to those that are injured in combat. Be proud to wear this for the rest of your life. On behalf of the president and a grateful nation, okay, I present you the Purple Heart, all right, for wounds received in combat, all right? Your mission, get better, all right? So get better quick, all right? And we'll see you soon, huh?
Oh, sure.
Okay. All right. Congratulations.
You know, that's one award I never wanted to see you get.
There's an image, and this isn't at all gory, this image I'm about to describe, but it really sticks with me. You know, I always thought that when a wounded soldier gets a Purple Heart, that in my mind it was always like after they'd recovered a little bit and they're wearing their military uniform, that the Purple Heart is then pinned on the uniform. That was the image always in my mind. In your movie, you show a man who's on the gurney, he's just been injured, he's not wearing clothes, he's bare-chested, and the Purple Heart is just placed on his bare chest. And he might still be kind of in shock because he's not showing a lot of emotion. And I just found that a very moving moment. Go ahead.
What's interesting about him at that moment is that he has one of the largest tears that I've ever seen rolling down his cheek, because he's still remembering his friend who had his face completely blown off and was killed right next to him in the Humvee. Oh. And it's sort of an interesting irony that he's being praised for his service while he's weeping for his lost comrade. And then as the scene continues, they wheel in his other buddy, who was also on a gurney, also half-clothed, and they basically hold each other and weep.
Did every soldier who came to that hospital have the Purple Heart placed on their chest, like was done to this soldier?
Not all Purple Heart ceremonies are performed that way, although walking around the hospital, you will see a lot of Purple Hearts pinned to pillows. Purple Hearts are rewarded in the field sometimes, back at hospitals in Germany and in the United States. It really depends under what circumstances they think it's best to give you that award. And I think in some ways, it's linked to something that struck me about the entire military structure was the attention to emotional well-being of the soldiers, so that if a commander thought it would somehow be helpful and healing to receive that award, he would present it still as they were recovering from the wounds that they received in combat. And a lot of decisions were made in those moments to try to help soldiers find closure with the horrors they were experiencing. And another thing you see in the film along those lines is the constant presence of a chaplain inside the hospital. Now, that chaplain was responsible for every soldier that came in the door, plus the 350 members of the combat support hospital who were witnessing that horror every day. And he just worked double shifts for every day he was in Iraq. And the Army places as much importance on the spiritual care and the mental care of these soldiers as they do on the physical care. And that was another unexpected thing that I witnessed there in Baghdad.
John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill speaking with Terry Gross. Their documentary, Baghdad ER, about a combat hospital in Iraq, has been selected for a Peabody Award. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children. On the web at covertheuninsured.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation about wounded soldiers and their doctors at the 86th Combat Support Hospital in Iraq. We remember novelist Kurt Vonnegut, who died Wednesday at the age of 84. And David Edelstein reviews Black Book, the new World War II era film by Dutch filmmaker Paul Verhoeven. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with filmmakers John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill. Their HBO documentary Baghdad ER has been honored with the 2006 Peabody Award. The film was cited as a horrifying and humbling testament to the dedication of medical personnel confronting the overwhelming carnage of war. The film is now out on DVD.
At the end of the film, one of the soldiers in the hospital dies, and the chaplain says a prayer over his body. And what I'd like to do is actually play that prayer, play that scene.
Was he chaplain?
He is no religious preference, sir.
I see.
So we won't do any last rites or anything.
Right. We'll offer just a prayer for his life. And
I'll pray with you.
Yeah, sure, okay. Sir.
All right.
Okay, let's pray. Heavenly Father, gracious God, we did everything we could to save his life. The EMT worked very hard, and the surgeons, and Lord, we did everything we could. But Lord, we pray that his life and his death would hasten the cause of peace. And this senseless war, this violence here would end, and he would be one of the last. But Lord, again, we pray for your comfort and your peace on his family and his friends. And we say thank you for his life. In Christ's name I pray. Amen.
That's a chaplain in a combat hospital in Baghdad from the new documentary, Baghdad ER. Do you think that having the camera in front of your eyes helped distance you in some way from all the carnage that you were seeing in the hospital and enabled you to see it? Like, would it have been harder to see without having the camera between you and the injuries?
I don't know if it was so much the camera or the job, because to have to stand in that room without having a job to do would be humiliating, because everyone around you was moving at 100 miles an hour trying to save somebody's life. And I think it deepened our sense of purpose and responsibility about the story we were going to tell, because this camera that we were holding in our hands was our tool to do something about this situation. And you felt so acutely your responsibility because you were surrounded by doctors who felt responsibility for saving that life. And as far as the technical use of the camera, it was so much easier to worry about how my shot was framed and whether or not I had two channels of audio coming through the camera than it was to actually think about the 19-year-old that was dying in front of the lens.
Do you have nightmares after having seen so much suffering and so many amputations?
Well, you know, Terry, everybody gets affected in different ways. And I like to think that I'm a tough guy and that I can take all this. But I was flying back on the airplane coming out of Iraq, and they were showing a movie. And I hadn't seen a movie or television in 2 months. And it was some cartoon movie called Stripes about a zebra that competes in the Kentucky Derby and the little girl that took care of him. And as the movie's reaching its conclusion, as the zebra wins the race and the little girl hugs him, I began weeping. I'm actually starting to cry now. I began weeping uncontrollably. And everybody who was sitting next to me on the plane began to look, you know, why is this guy crying about this cartoon movie? And I came back and I told Matt that story. And he had a similar experience on his plane.
And I had the same experience watching an Ashton Kutcher movie where in the end he's singing to his loved, you know, long-lost love with a guitar, a movie that I would usually guffaw at and make fun of, and found myself sitting on this plane with the tears coming down my face. I think, you know, there's so much pent-up emotion from the time that we were there that once we were out, it just came flowing.
John, do you think that's what it was about?
I have to believe that, because you just have to stuff all this stuff deep, deep inside you. Otherwise, you get paralyzed. And there's at the most unexpected time, there's something that triggers those emotions. And I don't cry. And I'm sitting here in the studio right now with tears running down my face, and I'm somewhat embarrassed.
It's the strangest triggers. There's whenever I smell dirty feet, stinky feet, it takes me right back into the emergency room, because these soldiers would come in injured after having been on patrol, and sometimes they wouldn't have had a chance to take a shower or wash their feet for over a week. And I remember vividly one big, strong-looking Marine who is in the film and who lost his life, and he was so strong. And his feet smelled so terrible, just like my feet smell after I've been hiking in the woods or working hard, doing something. And the entire time I was with him, as the doctors fought to save his life, I smelled his stinky feet. And now I'm almost obsessive about keeping my feet clean, because every time I smell bad feet, it takes me back to that moment and back to that sense of helplessness, that there was nothing I could do to help save this Marine's life while all the doctors around had all the skills to try to save him. And I was helpless to do anything. But in the end, they were all helpless to do anything.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us about your movie. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Terry.
John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill directed the documentary Baghdad ER about the 86th Combat Support Hospital in Iraq. It's been selected for a Peabody Award for Broadcast Excellence, which will be presented in June at a ceremony in New York. Coming up, we remember novelist Kurt Vonnegut, who died Wednesday. This is Fresh Air. Writer Kurt Vonnegut died Wednesday in New York at the age of 84. His wife, photographer Jill Kremenz, reported he'd suffered irreversible brain injuries after a fall several weeks ago. Vonnegut wrote plays, essays, and short stories, but it was his 14 novels that made him a literary icon, especially popular on college campuses. They were a unique blend of science fiction, humor, and philosophy, often dealing with dark themes of human cruelty. His first novel, Player Piano, was written in 1952. Time Quake, published in 1997, was his 14th and final novel. Vonnegut was born in Indianapolis in 1922. He served in an infantry unit in World War II, and after seeing action at the Battle of the Bulge, was imprisoned in an underground meat locker in Dresden when the city was firebombed by Allied forces. The experience would form the basis of his best-known novel, Slaughterhouse-Five, published in 1972. Though now required reading in many literature classes, for years it was banned from some school and library shelves. Terry Gross spoke with Kurt Vonnegut in 1986. He described how he survived the firebombing of Dresden.
Well, it was merely a matter of luck, as there were no air raid shelters in Dresden because an air raid was not expected. The Germans had believed it to be an open city. There, in fact, is no convention in war. I guess there wasn't medieval times, but they did not expect an attack, and there didn't seem to be any strong reason to attack it, so there were no air raid shelters. And it was a beautiful city like Vienna or Budapest or Prague. And one night, as the British came over, they're the ones who did the firebombing, really. The Americans dropped the high explosives. But the whole city was burned down, and all there was to hide in was cellars. And we happened to be quartered. Our work crew of American prisoners of war was quartered in a slaughterhouse. One thing, there weren't many buildings around. There were just a few large buildings, so the firestorm wasn't very intense there. Also, we were in a meat locker way under the street, so it would have been the place for Hitler to be, anybody to be. It was the safest place in Dresden, accidentally. So that's how I survived.
And then when the bombing was over, you had to go upstairs and dig out corpses.
Well, what we did first was the city had to cool off before we could walk around. I mean, it was like a volcano or something like that. You had to wait for the lava to cool off. But we stayed down for quite a while, I forget how long, and finally came back up. And then we had to walk and walk and walk until we could find someplace else to stay. There was nobody to lead us. I mean, we just had guards who were corporals and privates and sergeants, and they didn't know where the hell to go, and there was nobody for them to ask. So they marched us out on the edge of town and found us a place to stay out there. But then the city began to get organized, what was left of it and all that, and we were organized into work crews to go in and dig bodies out from underneath the street. And I have looked at movies of the liberation of concentration camps in Germany, where the SS was made to carry the corpses to the lime pits or to the graves or whatever, while a whole lot of people watched. And the moral situation isn't analogous at all, but the political situation is I have carried corpses while civilians watched and thought it served me right to be carrying corpses.
What do you mean?
Because I was an American and the corpses had been created by Americans and British.
When did you realize you were going to write about it? Was it then or years later?
I felt that it just kept nagging at me. It took me a while to realize that this was an important historical event, and it turns out to have been the largest massacre in European history. Now, massacre is something that happened suddenly. As heaven knows, that Auschwitz killed many, many more people, but slowly, you know, in an industrial manner. And in just one big whoosh of killing a whole lot of people suddenly, Dresden held the record, and I had been there. And so I decided, I'd better write about this, because I was a professional writer, and I'm always casting about for what to write about next. It took me a long time to do.
Did the writing about it change the way you remembered it? Did it bring back memories that you hadn't remembered, you know, things that you hadn't remembered? Or did you see it through a different filter because you were older then and had experienced more?
Well, for one thing, I had one of the filters I'd seen it through was war movies about World War II and war books. And, of course, they featured Frank Sinatra and Duke Wayne and all that. And it took me a long time to realize that this war was, in fact, fought by children, you know, and not these middle-aged 4F movie actors. And so that's what one thing that made the book bizarre, that, in fact, the infantrymen were teenagers, which is not usual in an American war story.
You've joked that you're not only one of the few survivors of that bombing, but you're the only person to have made a profit from it, because through royalties for your book, you've made about $3 per person killed in Dresden. And I was wondering if you had ever experienced what's sometimes called survivor's guilt.
Probably in some other situations, not the Dresden situation. I did lose several friends. There were 100 of us in that prisoner of war camp, a little labor gang in Dresden, and 5% of us died, didn't make it back home for one reason or another. That's not enough to give you survivor's guilt, I guess. I will issue the challenge again here, because a lot of people get mad at me for having talked about the destruction of a Nazi city, you know, and I saw it, which is the reason I wrote about it, and there's no reason for me to keep it secret that I saw it. But another thing is that absolutely nothing was gained by it, and I'll issue the challenge again here, that nobody in this whole world benefited from that air raid but me. That not one person got out of Auschwitz a microsecond earlier, not one German soldier fell back from his foxhole on the Russian front or the American front. Nothing was changed at all. And that I'm the only person who benefited, and I got $3 and maybe $4 for each person killed there. And so this is going out over radio. I've done it on BBC and so forth, and that first letter has yet to float in. It's, hey, if it weren't for Dresden, whatever.
As popular as your books are, they've also been banned by some school libraries, by some regular libraries. How do you usually find out about it? What do they tell you? And do you find out directly from the person who banned the book when it's banned?
No. You pick it up from newspapers, or you hear talk or whatever. You have to chase down cases of censorship, and of course, it's a huge country. My publisher and I have an agreement that whenever we hear of such a case, our primary interest is in offering help to the librarian or the teacher who has gotten into trouble as a result of recommending a book by me. And we also tell the ACLU, I can't think of a case that we've reported to the ACLU that they didn't already know, because they have chapters all over the country, and I have no such spy system out. So it's catch as catch can, as I hear about it. There's no reason for me ever to testify in court, and so I'm not a participant in any censorship case.
Can you describe some of the passages in your book that are responsible for them being banned?
No, neither can the book banners, as they customarily haven't read them. And these are nice people. They're usually not very well educated. They have kids. They want to help the community in some way. They run for the school committee. And so suddenly, for the first time in their lives, they are dealing with books since high school or whatever. And so they are over their heads. But there are organizations which will give them lists of bad books, which they don't even have to read. Are these books on your shelves? And so they will go, and indeed some of them are. There's an awful lot of them are out of print. There's apparently the basic list, which includes Slaughterhouse-Five. It also includes Deliverance and Catcher in the Rye. Apparently it was circulated. It's just Xerox now. It was apparently circulated by 1971, because no book on it was published after that time. A lot of the books on that list are out of print now, as they're so unpopular. I get letters from the Soviet Union. I'm published over there. I get letters of sympathy saying that they're so sorry my books are being burned over here, and that they want me to know that my books will always be available over there. Obviously, in the Soviet Union, they've made a great deal of the very minor and rare cases of censorship in this country. I think what's new is not the censorship, but the opposition to censorship. As I think for 200 years, people have been perfectly free to censor school libraries, public libraries. Nobody's opposed them. And what is new is that suddenly they're being opposed.
You've taught writing, and you've taught it over a period of several years. Yet, when you were young and first starting to write, you'd never been a student of writing or been a student of literature as your major in college. Do you think that hurt or helped you in any way? Because you were a major in science, not in literature or writing.
No, if I had met someone like myself, I would have felt a lot more confident about becoming a writer. And I also would have known a lot. Almost everything I found out about writing, I learned the hard way, whereas, in fact, it was all in Aristotle's Poetics. Now, there are a few fundamental things that are known about storytelling, simply because some stories have succeeded and others have failed. So I can be like a golf pro, is I can stand to one side and tell you to swing your club. And I'll say, all right, put a little more weight on your left foot, is move your thumb down a quarter of an inch, and the ball will go 50 feet farther. And you won't yourself know what the hell you were doing wrong. And there are things you can do wrong in storytelling. I mean, these are mechanical things. So I can be helpful in that way.
Because you weren't studying literature and because you didn't have teachers criticizing your writing, was writing more fun to you when you were younger than it might have been if you were a serious student of it?
Reading was a lot more fun, too. I've never done. I've always read for pleasure, and I've never had to explain afterwards what the author had done to prove that I had understood the book at all. Writers will come out of almost any department but the English department. And this is not to insult English departments. When I say this in a lecture, everybody says, oh, yeah, hoo-hoo, what a bunch of jerks in the English department. Well, it's not the purpose of an English department to turn out creative writers. It's to turn out literary historians, cultivated people, and people who will in turn teach people the wonders of their language and their literature. But one thing an English department will do will teach you good taste too soon. And so when you can't write very well but are starting out, you will be horrified when you compare yourself with James Joyce at the peak of his powers, or Proust, or Mark Twain, or whatever. And so when I was in the chemistry department at Cornell, writing for the Cornell Sun, I thought everything was wonderful, and I thought what I was doing, you know, I didn't know any better, so I dared to begin.
I hesitate to ask you this, but do you have any books of yours that are, to you, representative of your best work? Are there ones that you are...
Oh, well, there are ones I'm particularly fond of, sure. I've graded them one time. I gave grades to all my books, and it was just how I felt that day about each book. But I'm very pleased with my career. Here I am, 64 years old, or 62, and I never expected to write this many books and to be satisfied to the extent I am with them. Because my grades weren't particularly good in school, and prognosis did not seem good. So I'm proud to have finished the book.
Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your time with us.
Well, pleasure.
Kurt Vonnegut speaking with Terry Gross in 1986. Vonnegut died Wednesday in New York. He was 84. Coming up, David Edelstein on Black Book, the World War II era film by Paul Verhoeven. This is Fresh Air. Director Paul Verhoeven hasn't made a film in his native Holland since his 1983 thriller The Fourth Man, which led to a long and lucrative Hollywood career making action, suspense, and sci-fi movies. His new film Black Book returns to the setting of his 1977 film Soldier of Orange, which focused on the Dutch resistance in World War II and those who betrayed it. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
After the Dutch director Paul Verhoeven conquered Hollywood with the sardonic splatterfest RoboCop and the swank noir Basic Instinct and got down in the muck with the high camp Showgirls, he returned to his native Holland to make Black Book. Verhoeven must have had surgery to get his tongue detached from his cheek. The movie is old-fashioned in a way that's thrilling. It's a great piece of storytelling, a cloak-and-dagger picture that's lush and romantic, with just enough Verhoeven-esque cynicism, at least until the last act, to give it an edge. The movie is set in Holland under Nazi occupation. Its heroine, a young Jewish woman played by Carice van Houten. Her name is Rachel, but it's changed to Ellis when she ends up working for the Dutch resistance after her family is betrayed to the Nazis. She dyes her hair blonde and goes undercover at Gestapo headquarters. And there she sleeps with the head man, Muntz, played by Sebastian Koch, the conscience-ridden playwright from The Lives of Others. Now, the vast majority of filmmakers drop to their knees whenever Nazis and Jews show up in the same movie. But Verhoeven doesn't let the Holocaust paralyze him with solemnity. Through Rachel's eyes, we see the German occupation of the Netherlands in a way that turns our standard perceptions topsy-turvy. The Dutch who risk their lives to hide Jews sometimes betray them to save their non-Jewish countrymen. Resistance fighters make secret deals with Germans. The resistance is still lionized in Holland, where Black Book has caused an outcry. But to my mind, the ambivalent portraits make these saviors seem more complicated and more human.
We also see that the Gestapo knows how to throw swell parties. Black Book peaks when Rachel, who has a gorgeous voice, finds herself singing a bawdy song accompanied by the piano stylings of the Nazi who ordered her family shot. The scene is frightening, glamorous, exhilarating, disgusting. As Rachel's resistance lover, played by Hans Ackermans, watches her come and go from Muntz's bed, Black Book recalls Hitchcock's emotionally labyrinthine double-agent melodrama Notorious. And then it goes in unexpected directions. Most of Verhoeven's movies show women getting far by using their feminine wiles and hot bods, and critics are divided on whether this is sexism or a very bitter realism. I think it's a bit of both, but I respect Verhoeven for calling the question in his work so bluntly. Now, before I yell, auteur, auteur, it's important to say that in the last 20 minutes or so, the director's trademark cynicism swamps the picture to the point of absurdity. The indignities Rachel suffers are like something out of the horror film Carrie, and there are so many crosses and double crosses that I gave up trying to diagram the conspiracy. We know there were moral upheavals in the first months of the post-war era. Mobs assaulted and strung up collaborators. The American military coddled some Nazis in anticipation of the next war with the Soviets. But something is kerflooey in a movie where you root for the Jewish girl to run away with the nice Gestapo fella. Even these cavils are testament to Black Book's marvelous storytelling, linear but with killer curves. Which brings me to Carice Van Houten, with her soft, heart-shaped face and blue eyes. I don't mean to drool. I just think the movie wouldn't work if Verhoeven hadn't found an actress so naturally, ripely beautiful that it's unthinkable she wouldn't use the weapon she has. And in the world of Black Book, pay a terrible price.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Our show was directed today by Jonathan Menjivar. Terry Gross returns Monday. I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of Necessary Sins, a memoir by Lynn Darling about marriage, loss, and the many lessons that can be taught by love. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from Bonterra Vineyards, Mendocino, California, fine wines made with organically grown grapes and respect for the earth. Bonterra promotes responsible drinking. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Don't take your love away from me.
50 years in showbiz. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with singer-songwriter Neil Sedaka. He was one of the original creators of the Brill Building sound in the late 50s and 60s, but he got his start as a classical pianist. Sedaka has a new collection of his hits. Join us for the next Fresh Air. You help me